Okay. We do not have a quorum yet, but I think we're going to get started. Okay. Members, today we're going to be hearing from Jane Rankin from the DHS. Members, okay. Today we're going to be hearing from Jane Rankin from the DHS to give us an overview of the new CMS memo on the ARRA provision. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jane Rankin. I'm the Budget Director at DHS, and with me is Ann Burke, who is the Acting Medicaid Director at DHS. I am going to talk about the CMS guidance that we received last week that has information about the eligibility maintenance of effort requirements as part of the federal stimulus bill, and Anne is really the subject matter expert, so depending on the level of questions, I'll handle them or I'll turn it over to Anne. So Madam Chair and members, you have the actual guidance. It's the 11-page document that's titled American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, subtitled Section 5001, Increased Federal Medical Assistance Percentage. I also had the page put in your packet, a little one-page handout that MMB used last week when there was a meeting of the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy. It's a very high-level summary, and we'll talk about things in more detail here today, but I thought a one-page handout might be useful as well. So if you haven't seen that, that's why it's in your packet. Madam Chair and members, on March 25th, we received this written guidance from CMS, and we now have some clarifications about the maintenance of eligibility requirements that are in the federal stimulus law. And as you all know, these are important because it is one of the requirements that we have to meet in order to qualify for the enhanced federal Medicaid federal match percentage. That
and we do have a quorum, so I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. Thank you. Please continue. You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The guidance now clarifies for us that we know that the maintenance of eligibility requirements applies to our Medicaid program. It also applies to our 1115 waivers, and it applies to our combined Medicaid and CHIP waivers. We know that we can't increase premiums if by doing so that would result in ineligibility. We also can't eliminate or reduce if we have income or asset methodologies that are more favorable. We also can't change how we can't add verifications of income and assets unless it's necessary to comply with federal verification requirements. We can't shorten the frequency of the eligibility redeterminations. There's a whole level now of specificity that we have that gives weight to that phrase that was in the law about procedures, standards, and methodologies related to eligibility. Importantly, one of the things we now know is that we can't eliminate an eligibility group or a subgroup. We also understand that we can't move to a more restrictive definition of disability if it affects eligibility. What this means, when I was presenting the governor's supplemental budget proposal last week, I flagged for you three governor's proposals that we indicated we had some questions about, but that we thought we would be able to go ahead with. And what we now know from this guidance that we received last week is we have more information about those, some of those proposals. We now know that changes and reductions in optional benefits are allowed. We understand that the governor's proposal about the PCA changes, that proposal would be in compliance with the MOE requirements that we have from CMS. We've also learned that there's another governor's proposal about the nursing facility level of care. And we understand now with this guidance that as that proposal is currently conceived, it violates the MOE requirements. The third proposal that I flagged for you was the limiting the growth in the disability waivers. And that one, our view on that is that we don't yet know. We're still waiting for more guidance from CMS. It's not clear to us whether that proposal, as currently included in the governor's budget, would be allowed to go forward or would violate maintenance of efforts. The other thing that I
excuse me, Ms. Rankin, we have a question. Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair and Ms. Rankin, on the growth and waivers, I thought the stimulus says that you could go back to the number of people you had enrolled in a program, whenever the October of this year, and you could hold it at that level. That's the way I read that. You're telling me that's not the case.
Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, I'm going to let Ms. Berg answer your question.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, that's how I would interpret the economic stimulus law as well. The problem is that guidance uses terms like slots and approved slots and capacity, and all of those terms are not clearly point in time enrollment on July 1st, and so we've asked some follow-up questions there.
Representative Hatch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I'm interpreting differently, but with the governor's proposals for the PCA changes, that they're meeting the MOE requirements, I just want to read what the information that I have in front of me, and that similarly, the state or territory must not have eliminated the coverage for any eligibility group or subgroup authorized pursuant to 42 CFR, whatever. How can you say that subgroups aren't being affected with eligibility on the requirements for like the two ADLs or the requirements for the live-in qualified professionals?
Ms. Burns, would you like to take that?
Madam Chair, Representative, the guidance really speaks to changes in benefits that affect overall Medicaid eligibility. And really doesn't say affirmatively changes in the benefit set that don't affect overall Medicaid eligibility, don't violate the maintenance of effort requirement. So I requested that clarification from CMS and received it in writing on Monday. But that's also, I believe, implied in the guidance that we received last Wednesday, which is they're making a distinction between reducing an optional benefit and reducing eligibility for the program for some people. The PCA proposal may affect some PCA benefits for some people, but it doesn't affect enrollment in the Medicaid program overall, and that's where they're drawing that distinction.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Huntley, I'm not sure who to ask, but can you make sure that the committee or somebody can get that clarification that you referenced from CMS?
Certainly.
further other questions? Please continue.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the other thing I wanted to run through for you is where the department is at as far as our ability to begin to draw down the enhanced federal funds. The funds became available to states going back to October 1st of last year, and we draw them down a quarter at a time. So we look at each quarter from the first one from October to December, and then we are just now in the last day of the second quarter where we would be able to draw the enhanced funds. Minnesota has not yet drawn down any of the enhanced funds, and that's because there are elements that we need to certify that we are meeting. And once we touch a dollar of the enhanced federal money, we are passively attesting to the that we meet the requirements that they have specified. There are one of the elements is about not restricting eligibility beyond what it was last July, and that's really a concern more, I think, for the budget deliberations going forward. We know we have looked back at this point back to last July and know that there weren't eligibility changes that would affect our ability to attest to that requirement. Another requirement is that you can't deposit the enhanced funds directly or indirectly in a reserve account. And we know that you enacted a law earlier this session that took care of that issue from our perspective. Because we now know that there will be a surplus in fiscal 9, but it is not going into the budget reserve because of the law that you enacted. So we meet that one. There's a prompt pay requirement that states have to meet that has to do with the percentage of clean claims that you pay within a certain number of days. That requirement is one that actually that goes into effect as of the day the stimulus law was enacted. So that applies beginning February 18th. It doesn't have any impact at all on our first quarter of possible enhanced funds. The last one is a requirement that a state cannot be increasing the percentage of a local share if there's a situation where a local government is paying for a share of the medical assistance costs. And that's a situation where Minnesota does have a few of these situations where there's a local government paying the non-federal share. And for the most part, they are set in percentage terms, so they float just fine. But we have identified one particular situation where it's a flat dollar amount. And since the percentage now has been lowered, the flat dollar amount puts this one particular situation in violation of that provision.
Excuse me, Ms. Rankin, we have a question. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Rankin, I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about the prompt pay requirements and how it's already being implemented. It sounds like it's already being implemented, so you know probably that I have a piece of legislation I'm working on with the federally qualified health centers, and I'm wondering how this provision interacts with that legislation, if you have further advice.
Ms. Berg.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, I've spent a lot of time in meetings discussing the prompt payment requirement. I'm not sure what the application is to our payment structure for federally qualified health centers where there's an interim and a settle-up payment, I believe. We are expecting, CMS has not issued written clarification on a lot of things around prompt payment, and hopefully that we'll get some additional guidance there. The law that's been in Title 19 for a long time is we have to pay 90% of claims, clean claims within 30 days and 99% in 90 days. And I think with FQHCs, the issue is how do you define a clean claim? But that said, I haven't really gotten very much in depth in terms of how we pay federally qualified health centers now and how what our working definition is of a clean claim in those kinds of situations.
To follow up with Representative Murphy. Thanks, Madam Chair, and Ms. Berg. The prompt pay, it sounds like the prompt pay is in effect, but we don't know how really to implement it yet. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but is that an accurate assessment? Ms. Berg.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the prompt pay law has been in the federal law for a long time. What happened here with the economic stimulus law is they basically created a penalty, and it's a daily penalty requiring a daily test and a look back of 30 and 90 days from all claims that are coming in on any particular day, and applying the loss of the enhanced FMAP to all claims that come in today for claims that were received 30 and 90 days prior that were not paid on time. And so what's new starting February 18th is a very specific test and very specific reporting and very specific segregating of the federal claim for enhanced, for both the regular and enhanced FMAP starting forward on February 18th. So yes, we're looking at a law that's been around for a long time where Minnesota we were in compliance with it under our definition of what that compliance was, but things have changed because of the new test in the economic stimulus law.
And
thank you, Madam Chair. And just one final question. So have we incurred or could we have incurred a penalty at this point?
Ms. Burr.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, it's possible that we could have had an issue with claims received from February 18th, and now we don't think so. Some of that depends on where CMS lands in terms of how these rules are going to work, what's a clean claim, what does payment mean, those kinds of questions. But that said, we have been looking at our data, and there's a pretty high comfort level so far that we don't have an issue yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask a question about the Administration on Children and Family Services, cited Minnesota just recently as one of few states not meeting the MOEs for standards to receive the higher reimbursement under FMAP for adoption assistance funding. Wanted to know what actions you've been taking as this relates to 2009 and whether the unallotment in this category affected our status in that regard.
Ms. Rankin?
Madam Chair and Representative Bunn, the unallotment would not have affected that report. I heard for the first time about this list that Minnesota's on as far as the adoption assistance program is concerned, and I have honestly not yet had a chance to go look at that website to find out exactly what they're saying. It is true that we have, have not yet claimed any of the enhanced FMAP for medical assistance. We also have not yet claimed the enhanced FMAP that we know is coming our way through the adoption assistance and foster care program. And so I am suspicious that might be all the list is. Mm-hmm. That you're referring to, but I'm not familiar with it and need to look into that and get back to you.
Well, if you could just get back to the committee as soon as you have that information. I know it's fairly recent information for all of us on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Will do.
Further questions, members? Oh, Representative Dean.
Thank you. It's a question, Madam Chair. The question is from Ms. Rankin on page 4, of the handout, it talks about determination of eligibility, and you said with part of the requirements of the stimulus package that we can't ask people if they're eligible more frequently than we were previously asking them, from what I can understand from reading this. No, in 2008, we passed the health care reform bill. Could you talk about, we had changes in eligibility and how, what we asked for, when we asked for it in terms of eligibility from folks who received services. Do you know if that went into implementation or how that might be affected by this?
Madam Chair and Representative Dean, I do not have the answer to that question. I have to go back and look into that and get the answer for you.
Thanks.
Representative Huntley.
Ms. Rankin, I did a little math here, and it seems to me we got $460 million is available to us for the current fiscal year from the federal participation, and it looks to me like if we had, we're collecting, put that in the bank and collected interest on it at a pretty low rate, 2.5%, that we'd be getting about $1 million a month in interest. So how long is it going to take to meet these requirements?
Ms. Rankin.
Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, we think we are about a week away from claiming the first quarter, and then once we get the prompt pay guidance, we'll be able to claim the second quarter. So we certainly intend to move as quickly as is prudent to claim that money, because we know it has Minnesota's name on it.
Representative Stephen.
Well, I'm okay for now.
Please continue.
Madam Chair and members, that was the end of our presentation. Okay.
Representative Stephen.
Did you guys talk about SCHIP at all yet? Are you prepared to answer any questions about SCHIP and whether we're going to be able to draw down all our federal funding? My understanding is you had to submit your 2009 allotment numbers within the last month. And is Minnesota going to be able to get its full allotment for the 2009?
Ms. Bird? Ms. Rankin?
And if not, that's
Madam Chair, Representative Peason, we'll have to look into that and get back to you.
Representative Avar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And back to the waiver slot business, and I know you didn't know the answer exactly to that, but something I really am interested in knowing, whenever you figure it out, is, you know, the governor's proposal, they changed, there's some standards changed, but what if in a situation where there's been a fuzzy line about who gets in and who gets out, there's great variability amongst 87 counties about who's in and out on some of those programs, and some counties have a real clean line and some just aren't so clean. If a program were put into place to clarify that, without changing any words about eligibility, to make sure that everybody complied with that, as a result, 5% of people were deemed to be not eligible because they were never eligible. Is that something that would be allowed under these rules? Do you know?
Ms. Burke.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure I'm connecting why people would lose eligibility in an effort relating to the maintenance of effort requirement.
No, I'll say it a different way. Well, there's talk about Compass and about having better training. The training across the homogeneity of training across the state from county to county is not good. And so in one county you happen to be put in and you really never even qualified in the first place. If those people are turned out because they were deemed never to have qualified in the first place, is that going to violate the maintenance effort?
Ms. Burke.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think, one, the CMS discussion around the maintenance of effort is all in terms of a statewide number. I would be surprised to see
a statement from CMS that would link a termination of an individual eligibility who is not eligible for the program as a violation of the maintenance of effort requirement. But that said, that I've seen nothing in writing really directed at that issue.
All right. Well, that's something that I think that I think we have to look at as we try to balance this budget. And I think that we have been wrapping this on my head for a while to try to serve those people who truly are in the highest level of need. And I'm not suggesting changing any words about who's eligible. Just make sure that they're applied properly. I hope that doesn't violate our MOE. So you can find out. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final area, and I'm going through the document, and I appreciate getting the document. I think it helped us all sort of get our heads around this. I'm wondering about this, and if there's additional disproportionate share funding in the stimulus, and if so, what do we need to qualify for that? How much is available? Are we working on that? Do you have further advice?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, there is additional DISH funding in the stimulus bill. That DISH is treated completely separately from what we've been talking about up to this point. It is not something where there's enhanced FMAP that you qualify for. DISH is still a 50% match for Minnesota. What the stimulus law did is increase every state's allocation of DISH by 2.5% for federal fiscal year 9 and 10. And so for Minnesota, I don't have the numbers. I think I remember that it's something like $1.8 million is now additionally available for us in the current federal fiscal year. And that in order to claim that, we have to put forward a like amount of state resources.
Representative Murphy, do you have a follow-up for that?
I don't. Thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Let me just follow up on that, Ms. Rankin. Madam Chair, so we would have to appropriate state money to get the match on the DISH money for the current fiscal year?
Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, okay, I have to come clean. My understanding of DISH was about at the level that I was able to talk to the committee about.
Welcome to the club.
I will have to talk to the experts back at the department and get a little more depth to my understanding, and then I'll get that information back to you.
Madam Chair and Ms. Rankin, it's my understanding that we do have that $460 million available, and the governor plans to spend about half of it in this fiscal year and carry over the rest of it is the way the budget works right now. But there is money. What I'm saying, when we get that money, there is money there that we could match.
You're talking about the incoming federal stimulus money. Yes, I recognize that number now.
Further questions, members?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
Okay. I will move that House File 8 be recommended to pass as previously amended and returned to the Finance Committee. And Representative Simon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your time. I know during deadline time it's tough for you, so I'll try to make this as quick as I can. Members, as I think we can all agree, defrauding the taxpayers is always wrong, but it's even worse during economic times like these. But this year, I think we can do something about contractors in Minnesota who knowingly defraud our state government. And that's the key word here. It's those who knowingly do so. This bill is not aimed at people who accidentally or inadvertently or unknowingly do anything of the kind. Only those who, quote, knowingly defraud the government. And at the same time, we can earn Minnesota a generous financial bonus from the federal government just for doing it. So just for passing this bill, even if no one ever uses it, if it still sits on the shelf forever, we get a bonus automatically, and I'll explain why that's the case. House File 8 is the False Claims Act. It's got 35 authors, the maximum. This is its fifth committee hearing. I've now had, myself, over 15 meetings with stakeholders. We've achieved global peace with one of them, the health plans. There are a few others who I think you're going to hear from who aren't quite there yet, but I'm also working with the governor's office on this bill, and we hope by the end of the week to have another meeting with the governor's office to iron out some final difficulties. All the state agencies, including DHS, are neutral on the bill. The original False Claims Act was known as Lincoln's Law because it was enacted during the Civil War as a way for the government to get at crooked contractors who sold bad mules and rotten food to the Union Army. A century later, in 1986, President Reagan signed the modernization of the Act, and basically the Act is more or less as it stood in 1986, which is this. Basically now, whistleblower employees can bring claims directly on behalf of the government, and then law enforcement authorities may choose later whether or not they want to intervene in the case. But either way, the employees who uncover knowing misconduct, and again, it's only knowing misconduct, not accidental, not inadvertent, knowing misconduct, those folks are entitled to a percentage of the ultimate judgment or settlement. And then the wrongdoer is liable for up to three times the government's actual damages. And as a result, the federal government has recouped over $22 billion, billion with a B, since 1986. But, of course, the federal law only applies to federal contractors, not state contractors. The states are on their own. Only the states can help states. And so 22 states have enacted their own versions of the False Claims Act to confront contractors, again, who knowingly defraud the system. This is a bipartisan idea. I told you that Ronald Reagan signed the modernization in 1986. Governor George W. Bush of Texas signed it in the 90s. And governors, both Democrat and Republican, all over the country have signed it. I should point out, too, that the chief patron of the False Claims Act in the U.S. Senate is not a Democrat. It's a Republican, Charles Grassley of Iowa. And so the various state laws have been particularly successful at rooting out fraud in programs like Medicaid that are funded jointly by state and federal governments. And you'll see in your handout, in your packet, a handout that demonstrates some of the really big recoveries, and not all of those are in the Medicaid realm, but some of the big recent recoveries by states that have a False Claims Act. And because of the success of the laws at the state level, particularly with respect to programs like Medicaid, Congress in 2006, and this is where Senator Grassley comes in 2006, provided a big financial reward for states that adopt the False Claims Act. And here's what Congress said in 2006 and what Senator Grassley said. He said, look, these laws are so effective at recouping dollars due to fraud that here's what we're going to do. We're going to sweeten the pot. And if a state passes a False Claims Act that meets four criteria, which this bill does, then each state that does that will be entitled to a 10% bump in their overall share of Medicaid fraud recovery. So, for example, if today Minnesota were to bring in $1 million in Medicaid fraud, we would keep five and the feds would get five. If we pass this bill, not if we use it, if we simply pass it and it still sits on the shelf forever, as I said earlier, if that happens, we get a 10% boost automatically. And by the way, you'll see some of the numbers in a second. Well, why don't we go to that now? If you look at the handout that you should have in your packet, and I know, members, I'm at risk of burying you in paper here, but there's one that says, Attorney General's Office Medicaid Fraud Recoveries Without the False Claims Act. Now, if you just take, and this is info and data directly from the Attorney General's Office of Minnesota, if you just take civil recoveries, let's be as cautious and conservative as we possibly can. Let's just throw out the criminal restitution altogether. Let's not even count that. Let's just look at the civil recoveries, and let's, just to be fair and even more cautious, let's toss out the one in the second year, since that seems like an outlier. It's kind of a spike. They must have had a good settlement that year. Let's grab that one out. Let's not even include that in the average, because it's going to throw off the average. It looks like a pretty good year, probably close to twice as much as they had in any other year in the last 7 or 8. Let's throw that out entirely. I did the math here, and had we had that law in place, we would have about almost $2 million extra per biennium, and that's just a federal bonus. That's not counting the cases that we would bring into the state because we passed the law. Just as a reward for passing the law, even if it's never used, we get about $2 million, almost $1 million per biennium, just as a bonus for doing it. So it makes sense for Minnesota, as it made sense for the other states, to do this. You can look at some of the examples yourself. So similarly, just like the federal act, our act would provide financial incentives to whistleblowers whose employers knowingly defraud our state government. And I think the key thing here, in terms of the government role in all of this, is we very consciously said, as about half the states do, that the state may intervene in the lawsuit, not shall, like some states do, but may. So if our Attorney General's office or our state doesn't want to be part of the False Claims Act business in terms of bringing the case and prosecuting the case, the state doesn't have to do that at all. And so you may hear today, as we've heard from some of the critics or the opponents, that the False Claims Act may subject innocent contractors to nuisance lawsuits by greedy insiders. But the fact is, this act only applies to contractors who knowingly defraud our taxpayers. No contractor will ever be liable for accidental or inadvertent wrongdoing. And the only allowable claims, and this is another key part, the only allowable claims come from those who are the, quote, original source, end quote, of the allegation. This is not a case at all where someone at the water cooler or in the lunch line at the cafeteria can overhear something come in and suddenly have a lawsuit on their hands. And there's reams and reams of case law out there in the other states and on the federal level about what constitutes the original source. This is someone with true insider knowledge who knows about something going on, again, knowingly, not accidentally.
If I could just interrupt, some people here have their cell phones on and it's affecting our recording. So if you have one that's turned on, even if you're not talking, it will affect our recording system. So in case we have a lawsuit over this case. Representative Simon.
Thank you. I'll try to wrap up. Another one of the arguments that you may have heard or maybe you will hear is that we already have laws on the books. Why do we need another fraud law on the books? Well, it's true, of course, every state has laws on the books preventing fraud, but the deal here is that none of those laws allow a whistleblower to stand in the shoes of the government, none of them provide financial incentives to those who root out the fraud, and none of them entitle us to that federal bonus that we just talked about. So, you know, the whistleblower component of this is really key because of the fear of reprisals. Over 80% of False Claims Act cases are initiated by whistleblowers. And, you know, one thing that really struck me, members, is the whole example of Tom Petters. We've all read about it. We've all heard about it. And while that is not a case under the False Claims Act, it's not even a case, as far as we know, of fraud against the government, I think it's instructive still. And the reason it is, I think, and the reason I think it shows the importance of whistleblowers is if you read all the papers, the stories in the paper, you'd know that the feds had no idea this was going on. There was a woman named Deanna Coleman, age 42. She was the right hand to Tom Petters, who literally, in a pang of conscience, walked off the street and into the FBI office and spilled the beans as to what was going on there. And the feds have said on the record, which I found quite surprising, they had no lead, no hunch, no inkling whatsoever that this was going on. And had she not done that, it's very possible that his Ponzi scheme would still be going on today. And again, it's somewhat apples to oranges. It's not an exact fit as an analogy, but I think it's instructive in terms of how important whistleblowers are. You might hear a little bit about frivolous lawsuits. Well, Section 12 of the bill, I think, ought to take care of that. It provides for the severe penalty, which is payment of attorney's fees and costs in case of a frivolous lawsuit. We've taken out retroactivity here, members, and that's where I want to get to the reason that this is before this committee, which is the fiscal note of the Department of Human Services for $118,000 for 1.0 FTE. I've met with members of the department. We just part company, and we have a good faith disagreement about the need for a fiscal note. The reason, members, that I think there isn't the need for a fiscal note, there are a few, one of which is we don't have retroactivity anymore. That was an original part of the bill. We got rid of that. That means this only applies to conduct arising on or after August 1st, 2009, the presumptive enactment date. And although nothing's a cinch and nothing's a guarantee, I think it is extremely unlikely that in the first couple of years of this of enacting this bill that you're going to see a flood of lawsuits. That has not been the case in other states. And I should point out, as I've said, and I didn't want to bury you with too much paper, members, but I have here the evidence, if anyone cares to see it, and I brought a couple extra copies. We looked at fiscal note material from all the other states that have enacted the False Claims Act. Only one state that we could find had any sort of fiscal note whatsoever for their similar agency. They call it something different there, but that was the state of Missouri. And the reason Missouri had a fiscal note whatsoever was because they had a specific audit and reporting function, an annual audit and annual reporting function right there in the bill, and we don't have that. But other than that, we were able to find no state in America that had a fiscal note for their Department of Human Services or whatever they may call it in their state. And so we just have a difference of opinion on that. This imposes no new burden on the department. Remember, there's already a federal False Claims Act. It already exists right now. So whenever Minnesota is implicated in one of these national multi-state cases, the Department of Human Services right today on March 31st is already doing that work. It's already happening. The only difference here with this bill, if we pass it, is basically who gets paid and how much. And under this bill, just by passing it, we get a bonus. And I'm convinced that in the medium to long run, we'll get a lot more than that. And you can see the evidence of what some other states have recouped. But we part company, and we just have a different opinion with the agency. I honor the work that they do, but I think their fears of increased workload and the spike in litigation in the first couple of years here are respectfully, I believe that they're not well-founded. So, Mr. Chair and members, if we just have a couple members minutes, because it's not often that he's available like this, I wanted to introduce you and just have you here for a couple minutes from somebody who I think is a real hero. You may have seen him on CNN or in the Star Tribune or in the national or local media. His name is Neil Thompson, and he is an actual whistleblower, and he can explain to you why the whistleblowing component is so important. If you could just indulge him for a couple minutes, member.
Mr. Thompson, would you state your name for the tape?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Neil Thompson, and I want to give the committee some of my perspective on the Minnesota False Claims Act. I'm a whistleblower, and I spent 3.5 years of my life helping the state of Minnesota and the federal government recover taxpayers' money. I'm the individual that you've seen on CNN or even on the cover of Law and Politics lately, and along with my colleague and friend, Dan Vierantz, we turned in Walgreens for Medicaid fraud and recovered $9.9 million for the federal government, and share of that was shared with the states. I've been a pharmacist for 31 years, first working for my father in the neighborhood pharmacy and owning that pharmacy later, and then later years I sold the pharmacy and went into the practice of law and was actually working at some of the large chain pharmacies here in Minnesota. And I can confidently tell the committee that even though you've seen some of these large awards under the False Claims Act, you would not have seen any of them had it not been for whistleblowers turning in most of these cases. Fraud by its very nature is it's covered up, it's hidden, it's perpetrated by some very smart people, usually done by sophisticated computer programs. And in my case, even 5 times I went to my supervisors and explained it to my supervisors and was rebuffed all times. And they said, well, that's being taken care of at headquarters, or you really don't know what you're talking about. And that's the nature of what happens in these cases is no one's going to believe you. So it takes people working on the inside of these companies that understand this kind of thing, that understand how the processes go on, and pharmacy billing is a very complex issue. They're hard to understand, even for people that do it on a day-to-day basis like I do. In fact, when we exposed this case, it took several meetings with the government officials and actually an expert in pharmacy billing to really explain it to them so they understood it. The very basis of all of our laws and all of the laws that you pass in the legislature is voluntary compliance and also voluntary exposure of the wrongdoings that are going on. Because without all of this voluntary compliance, the state doesn't have enough resources to investigate all of these things and the crimes, so it takes people on the inside. And you will not see these things exposed either if you don't protect the whistleblowers and compensate them for that matter, but you have to protect the whistleblowers. And in my case, I've done a lot of interesting things in my life. I've gone to the University of Minnesota Pharmacy School. I went to law school. I have a wonderful family. I've owned my own business. I've owned my own pharmacy. Had the honor of getting held up 8 times while I was doing that, and so there's all kinds of dramatic things that have happened, but nothing is as stressful as turning your employer in for Medicaid fraud and for 3.5 years walking into your employer's office knowing full well that you caused the FBI to appear at their homes on a Sunday night and question them about their billing practices, knowing full well that when they find out about you, they may terminate you, or they may blacklist you, and in my case, I've applied for 5 different pharmacy positions since leaving Walgreens, and no one even calls me back. Because you have to understand that being a whistleblower is a career-ending event for most people. And many of them never even practice in the same profession, much less the same area. Most of them never work for the same employer again. And in my case, even though pharmacy is a highly in-demand profession right now, most pharmacy students coming out of the U of M have multiple jobs to pick from. Neil Thompson never even gets a call back. So it's important that you protect whistleblowers. It's important that you have whistleblowers to even know about these cases. Law does a lot of things. It helps deter fraud. I think a lot of times we don't see the deterrent effect that a law like this has, because it has some strength to it. You know, it allows for double, triple damages, penalty. It allows for the state of Minnesota, if we have a False Claims Act on the books, to have a seat at the table to negotiate those settlements. Right now, we don't. And many of the settlements are settled for single damages, and many of the big cases that are being settled are because the states put their foot down and say, hey, we have a law here too. We know there's a federal law, but we have a law here too, and we don't want to settle for just single damages. We could have done that with our own fraud laws. We want double damages. We want a penalty on this. So this law has a lot of strength to it, and it's necessary for the state of Minnesota to have a law. Not just for Medicaid fraud, it's for all of the other money that the state spends on in a whole lot, host of other areas. This law is not about Minnesota's share. And sure, we get an enhanced share, and it's not about what it costs the state versus what the state recovers. It's really about whether or not you're even going to have a chance to recover this money, because the state of Minnesota is already spending the money. It's already being cheated. It's just whether or not you will have a chance to recover the money that's already being cheated. So I encourage you to consider this, and I hope you pass this law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and we're going to have, there's some people here opposed to the bill, but we're also going to hear from the department as to the fiscal note, and then Representative Broad has an amendment. But let's hear from testifier first. So somebody from the department want to talk about the... No, let's just get the fiscal note first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Vicki Quinters from the Department of Human Services.
Welcome
and
to the committee.
Thank you. And my division is responsible for the CSRS unit, which is the Medicaid Fraud and Abuse Surveillance and Investigation Unit. We do consider this new work under this particular legislation. We've made some assumptions because we don't know the increase in cases that we will be dealing with. We do assume there will be substantial marketing by the private sector to encourage these cases. We don't know how big that'll be. And we certainly know that the AG has the discretion of whether to proceed with a case. But they have 60 days in which to make that decision. And how they're going to make that decision is put all the requests onto my unit to pull the data and the claims and possibly even go out to providers to collect time cards or whatever to determine whether or not they want to proceed with the case. So we'll still have the workload. Most of the settlements that the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit has received were national settlements, and we generally don't have any work to do with that other than I get to sign off on the state recovery. But for these cases, we assume that with every review that comes to the attention of the Attorney General's office, and even the private attorneys may make requests, that we will have to do analysis and do runs and collect data for them before they even decide to proceed. So that's the basis of our decision to ask for one analyst. It's hard to judge how many cases.
Representative
Murphy. Thanks, Mr. Chair and Ms. Turner. I want to talk a little bit about the assumption of marketing in the private sector as a result of passing the law. because the standard is knowingly. Someone has to knowingly submit a false claim. So you have to meet that standard. And so if there's substantial marketing, is that an assumption that there is already false claims knowingly being submitted, and that if we, you know, rattle the cages and market, that you'll see more claims come into you?
So, Chair, Representative Murphy, I think it's more that more cases will come to light, which is a good thing. But I don't assume more false claims will be submitted to the department for payment. I think we'll just expose more wrongdoing. Which is a good thing. But to determine whether the Attorney General's office will proceed with the case, that's where the labor comes to our agency.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. So can you tell us a little bit more about what it would entail? What you'd have to do now versus what you'd have to do differently if we pass the law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, this is all about guessing a major shift in workload. Currently, when we CSRS, that's the name of the unit, handles its own investigative cases, several hundred a year. But in addition, where there are cases that we refer to the Attorney General's Office for prosecution or they initiate on their own, they look to us for the initial investigation and the data collection, and we negotiate that out relative to our workload over time. But with this piece of legislation, as they decide whether to proceed on something, they have a 60-day timeline. So it's not something that we can sort of negotiate within our workload, our current workload, and decide, well, can you wait on that? Do you really want to bring that to prosecution now? There's no leeway for giving us a break or fitting it in into our current workload. But I guess I have assumed that there will be an increase in cases as a result of this legislation.
And Mr.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. That's the part that I don't understand. I don't understand the assumption. And you receive a lot of fiscal notes, and sometimes I don't agree with the assumptions, you know, about whether we can calculate a savings or if there's going to be a cost. I don't understand the assumption that there's going to be an increase in workload. So I just wish you could clarify that for me a little more, quantify that for me a little bit more.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I don't think we can quantify that. Are you saying you don't think there will be any marketing by private attorneys to encourage people to come forward, to encourage whistleblowers to take the risk and to come forward? I guess we're assuming that there will be.
And
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would want to know if you have a sense of the amount of false claims that are ongoing. I mean, that's the part I don't get. So how do we, if we don't know that there are false claims being submitted, how do we quantify that there are going to be more, right? I know that there's some mystery to setting a fiscal note,
right?
But it seems really soft to me that, you know, we're going to assume that there's going to be more, and that we could assume there's going to be marketing. I guess I would want to push on that a little bit too. Okay,
Mr. Turner. Just if I could interrupt, on page 2 of the fiscal note, in sort of the middle of the page, it says it is unclear how many of these cases will be brought forward. Ms. Gunner.
Mr. Chair, we currently conduct investigations based on cases that come to our attention from a real variety of areas. We get we have a hotline, and we get about 400 calls a month, and they're from employees, employers, neighbors, patients, whomever, who call us and says there's something wrong with this bill, that you shouldn't have paid this bill. And that's our own hotline. And that's one source. We also get calls from the FBI. We also get direct calls from attorney generals or other states or whatever. That's a very random basis under which we do our work. On a very limited basis, what would be preferable is if we could systematically do very random sampling and review cases to see where there's either false claims or inappropriate billing or whatever. We've only been able to do that with PCAs as one industry. So at this point, we can't judge what would be, you know, the true rate of false claims for any particular provider type, because we don't have the information. So I readily admit that this is a soft basis for estimating additional costs.
Representative Emmert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for that. I don't even know if I accept that it's soft. If you could explain to me just a little bit about the process, because if we're talking about a whistleblower, they're going to contact a private lawyer and they're going to tell them, here's what happened, and then I would imagine the private lawyer is going to ask for documents. And once they get those documents, they'll probably hire an expert, since this bill provides for reimbursement of expert witness fees, to do the very analysis that you're suggesting only your department can do, and that's just not making any sense to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen.
Representative Thiessen today.
Sorry, Representative Emmer, I'm sorry. I think we aren't the exclusive source for some of the analysis. I think the private attorneys will subpoena records from a provider or whatever. But I think they'll also make requests to us about our payments. We will also look at the pattern of payments to other providers in that category. It all depends on the unique features. I'm not presuming that our investigation will necessarily absolutely match up. I assume we can build on any information that we get from the private sector, but it doesn't completely take on all that we would have to do ourselves.
Mr. Chair,
another
question is, if the Attorney General brings these claims, where does the money go if it's recovered? Does the money go into the Attorney General's account, or does it go into the general fund? Where does it go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, any returns go exclusively into the general fund. The Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Unit, we work with their civil unit and their criminal unit as well as the fraud units, but their fraud unit gets 75% federal match for their administrative work, but they do not retain any of the recoveries. They all go to the general fund.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative?
We don't either.
Can you give us an idea over the last 2 or 3 years how much they've recovered that's gone to the general fund? That Medicaid fraud?
Ms. Gunner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Amber, it varies. They're almost always national settlements on pharmaceutical companies. And from the fraud unit, as opposed to our recoveries of the investigations we conduct, they're generally in the $2 to $5 million a year range.
And Mr. Chair, ma'am, my understanding is those pharmaceutical settlements are typically negotiated by teams, and Minnesota just gets to sign off and has received the money, even though, I won't even go into that. I'm interested to know what the fraud unit that we have in the Attorney General's office has done separate. In other words, not riding the coattails of another state or another team, but that we've actually done and what kind of money they've recovered.
Mr. Chair, Representative Amber, I would have to look that up. It would be much less because when they're prosecuting a provider, depending on the kind of provider, there may be little or no assets. It may just be closing down a provider that, you know, has meets the standard of fraud, and there is very little recoveries associated with it. Well, particularly like if it's a home care area, there's very few little assets to recover.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Just continuing, if there's very little assets to recover, then what kind of work does your office do when they contact you and they say, we've got this this potential fraud claim and we're going to proceed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, if they're telling us they're going to proceed, they've already received our analysis of, we've probably already done our work for them in terms of pulling claims from these providers, seeing how the pattern of claims vary from others in that category, looking at the ownership of that business compared to other healthcare providers. We've probably already done our work if they've made a decision to proceed.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, maybe you said it already, but how many of those did you do last year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ember, our division handles a few hundred cases a year. We refer maybe a few dozen to the Attorney General, and they initiate others on their own. So I would have to look in the records to see how many cases they prosecuted.
I would, Mr. Chair, I'd make a request. I'd like to have an actual list for the last 2 or 3 years. I'd like to know how many you have been asked to provide analysis on, and how many you've referred, and how many have actually been prosecuted. And then lastly, for Mr. Simon, Representative Simon, on the same issue, you've got this, and it's a part of the bill that concerns me, but you've got a shall award no less than double, and I'm paraphrasing, I think, but double the attorney's fees. Why wouldn't that compensate some of this cost that the witness is talking about? Why couldn't it be designed so that if there is some cost, whether we accept it or not, that it can be covered within the bill?
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, a couple of responses to that. First, in terms of the double damages, we're kind of hemmed in a little bit here by the fact that one of the four criteria in order to get the federal bonus is we have to be at least as restrictive as the federal government. So it's a floor, not a ceiling. So they have double damages, we have to as well. If we went below that, we wouldn't get the bonus. But as to your broader question about could the first dollar in of recovery go to recoup investigative costs, sure it could. I know that the state of Kansas right now is in the process of debating, or recently has been debating, a False Claims Act, and at least the Kansas Senate, when I left Ketch, has experimented with that idea. I've seen the bill language where they set up some sort of litigation fund where the state gets paid first dollar until their costs are recouped, and then the state general fund recoups after that. That is something we could do. I don't see it as necessary at this point, but there's no reason we could not do it.
Representative Simon, if we're getting $2 million a year, what would the bonus get us? We're getting $2 million a year from basically federal cases.
Sure.
Is what our share of
Mr. it. Mr. Chair, the 10% really is 20. It's not, and here's why. If we got $2 million a year, that means we got 50% of $4 million. So we got $2 million. 60% of $4 million would be, someone help me here. 60% of $4 million would be
24.
Okay, all right. 2.4 million. So we get a $400,000 bonus because we're getting 10% of the overall pie, not a 10% bump up bump on what we got. It's 10% more of the overall pie, which is a 20% bump to what we actually got. So 2 million turns into 2.4.
Okay, we're going to have to move on. I have one more questioner, and I will say we have three lawyers on this committee, and two of them were confused with each other. But the other one would definitely not be confused with those two. So, Representative Liebling.
Well, with that introduction, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how to take that. I wanted to go back to the questioning by one of the non-lawyers, Representative Murphy, one of our helpful nurses on this committee, about how many FTEs this calling for an additional FTE in this note, and the testifier who was just here, I kind of wanted to...
One. It is one.
Yes, but she got away, and I wanted to address my questions to her. If she could come back. Oh.
thought you were done.
Sorry, we weren't done with you here quite. Well, first of all, I wanted to know, first of all, how many people are in your department doing these investigations? What kind of staff do you have right now doing these few hundred cases a year that you were telling us about?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have 9 investigators, not counting TCAs, for about 30,000 providers.
Not towns and
services? Well, the TCAs are another 30,000. But for we are responsible for surveillance of all the provider types that we enroll for the Medicaid program, and we have 9 investigators.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Weedling.
And thanks. I didn't quite understand what you were saying about the PCAs.
Well, when you talk about the number of providers that have enrolled, PCAs have such a high number. That would make it like 60, 70,000, but half of that is individual PCAs enrolled in our program. So I didn't want to, you know, distort the proportion of the volume of providers who are responsible for oversight.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you. My question was really more to how many staff people you have doing the investigations, and you're saying that's 9 investigators?
Correct.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, and are those investigators, are they people that you hire kind of out of college, or what kind of background do they have?
Mr. Chair,
Representative, the investigators generally have several years of experience with police work, or they have nursing and insurance background, or pharmacy tech background.
Okay.
They often have experience with some form of investigation before they come to the department.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Where I'm kind of going with this is, first of all, back to the issue of the marketing, and you know, I think Representative Murphy's on to something here. I don't see the marketing, if we have to assume, I think, that the marketing is not going to create claims, but if there are claims, there, because of the penalties in the bill for filing a frivolous claim, I think we kind of need to assume here that any claim that's brought forward is a real claim, that there's, you know, at least a colorable, you know, probability that there is some fraud here and something to be recovered. So that's kind of the first thing. I don't really think that we should assume that we're going to suddenly create a rush of things here, unless we're also probably creating a lot of revenue to go along with that. But the other thing is I wanted to ask about the number of investigators and so on, because, first of all, in the fiscal note, you know, what you have for the cost of one FTE, which seemed a little bit high to me, but maybe with your explanation of who they are, maybe it's not so high when we're considering benefits and so on, but you have 103,000, you know, and then 93,000. So that's a goodly cost for one person. But then I think if you've got 9 investigators doing this already and you're talking about adding one, I mean, that's about a 10% increase. That you're talking about around a 10% increase in your workload. Is that what you're sort of, am I missing something here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the request for the position is for an analyst. It is not for an investigator. So we're making an estimate, but we think the demand or the request from the Attorney General's office for analytic work, largely pulling patterns of claims, is the basis of that fiscal note. We're not asking for another investigator.
Okay, and then Mr. Chair, just quickly finishing up with that. So what is it? So an analyst is, you know, where does? I mean, can you just justify us for us real quickly why an analyst comes out to this cost that you've got on the fiscal note?
The cost involves the office cost and the computer cost of setting up a new position. And we would generally look for an analyst with several years of experience with Medicaid, which is frankly a rare experience. And so it's a fairly high level analyst
that is familiar with claims data from a variety of providers. So a part of that is the cost of the administration and the indirect costs, including the benefits. It isn't, that isn't all salary.
Okay, I'll leave it there.
Okay, we're going to have to move along pretty quickly here because we have another section to do after this bill. So let's hear from the opponents. Start with Dave Renner. And if they could just line up, Dave Renner, Kari Cirillo, and David Feinemark. Hi, David.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm not Dave Renner. My name is Dave Feinwax, a fact for both, which Mr. Renner and I are grateful. I'm here representing the Minnesota Hospital Association this afternoon, and we are opposed and have concerns with this bill. Let me say at the outset that I had an opportunity last week to meet with Representative Simon and sit down with him and express some of our concerns, and I've come to the conclusion that he's not a half bad guy, and I'm here this afternoon to work on the other half. Our concern from this proposal stems from a number of sources. You've already heard it, so I won't repeat everything, but this involves complex computer-generated billings. And just so we're all perfectly clear, what this means is that if you submit a bill, a claim that's off by a nickel, and knowingly is a term of legal art, I won't bore you with whether or not it means absolutely you knew or just you put in the code you intended to put in that was wrong. If you submit a claim that's off by a nickel, you owe the government 15 cents plus $11,000 for every time you did that. And with computers, that adds up pretty quick. So naturally, we take it seriously. We're very concerned. The majority of states don't have this. I think 21, 22, the majority don't. This isn't the first time this has been considered in this legislature. I think it's the third time. But certainly this year, it is moving with more force. So having said all of that and having heard some of the testimony, what I want to do today is focus not necessarily so much on what we don't like, which many of you have heard before, but a potential way to remedy this. Everybody seems to agree that if there's an accident, if there's a lack of intention, if it's unwitting, that we shouldn't subject providers to frivolous litigation, to a complex process, and simultaneously people are tempted or desirous of trying to recapture additional revenues for the state, although from our perspective, you know, I don't think that's going to happen, but that's my opinion. So is there something we can do? I believe there is. What this measure needs is a provision that I'm going to call right to cure. And when I say right to cure, I mean as follows. What this provision needs is a concept where if an employee believes that there is false billing going on, in any sense, that a code is wrong, that things were done in error, that the government is being billed for X when X wasn't delivered, whatever the case might be, the simple requirement that the employee make that concern known to a designated compliance officer within an organization. And if that person says, I'm not interested, don't bother me, then it's open season. You can bring a QI-TAM litigation. You can go to the state or federal government, whatever. But at least give them the opportunity, these organizations, to look at that and say, holy smokes, we billed 017. It was supposed to be 019. Something's wrong with the computer program. Something's wrong with whoever decided which code this is. We're going to fix it. We're going to contact the government. We're going to work it out. This strikes me as a reasonable proposal to put an end to a lot of the rancor that surrounds this concept and to actually get it moving forward. Now, does anybody want to give fraudulent wrongdoers a pass? Of course not. Having said that, the people I represent, Minnesota's not-for-profit hospitals, have in their name, community, memorial, saint, county, region, we don't like being compared to shoplifters and thieves, even though when you look at our bill every once in a while, you might be tempted, but, these aren't bad people. This is a complex system of medical coding and billing, and in the interest of moving this thing along, we'd like to see it advance in a way in which we think it would be administered fairly, and this would be a way to do that. And so we would strongly support that concept.
Thank you. And next, looks like Dave Renner and Mr. Renner, if you could keep it really brief, because we've got a whole other section to go.
So, Mr. Chair, Dave Renner, Minnesota Medical Association, we represent physicians throughout the state, and I will mostly say ditto to what Ms. Feinlock said. We appreciate the amendments and the changes that Representative Stein has made with the bill, but we share the same concern with the fact that these are very complex billing processes, and I think if we could get some kind of a right-to-cure concept, I think we would also be comfortable with that. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Okay, so on Ms. Thurlow and Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members, at first I was going to say I'll be Thurlow and she'll be Carrie, but my name actually is Toby Pearson with Care Providers Minnesota. I'm here and Carrie can introduce herself when she's ready to speak. Our message is the same. Basically, providers need a right to cure. We appreciate the work that Representative Simon has done with us, the meetings he's taken. He's incorporated some suggestions, and I believe that, as was explained by previous testifiers, that getting that right to cure would make this bill a lot better. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Carrie Thurlow with Aging Services of Minnesota, speaking on behalf of the imperative. I'll just say ditto to also supporting the right to cure. I just want to be very clear here. The issue here is that we are trying to give every opportunity to correct situations and try to balance out this legislation so that we avoid fact patterns that are that could be triable, that would be resolved potentially in a provider's favor somewhere down the road, but this just makes a clear, bright line that gives us a chance to cure it before we get down that road where we're in lawsuit land. So thank you for the opportunity.
Any questions to Representative Rood?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just clarify for us, right to cure, what that means exactly? Maybe I missed something.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, I think our perception of a right to cure is basically what happens right now. That is, if something gets miscoded or if something gets misreported, that we then go back and we fix what the problem was. So we go and we report it, we fix it, we make make it right for the future.
Okay, let's go to the amendment. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is essentially an amendment that will go directly to the spirit of what Mr. Feinwatch was talking about related to ensuring that the hospital nursing homes and providers are less nervous about what this actually means. When I look through the legislation, Mr. Chairman and Representative Simon, on page 1.20, it says, talks about the knowing and knowingly, and it says, no proof of specific intent to defraud is required. So essentially, you're guilty, even if there's an easy explanation. And we all want to root out fraud. There's absolutely no doubt about that, and I think that's on a bipartisan basis. But I certainly think that there should be an opportunity for some of these providers and situations to ensure that their internal processes are not sidestepped. I think any time you encourage people to get outside of the system without at least giving them an opportunity or a path within the system, I don't think that we're doing the right things. And so want to make sure that we're not having increased false claims about false claims. And Mr. Chairman, I think this is a step in the right direction. I appreciate Representative Simon's work as well. I think if this committee puts this amendment on, we're going to continue moving in the right direction, because I do agree that it's important to protect whistleblowers, and it's important to protect the folks who are truly in there trying to help out a situation, and we need to deter fraud. But we also have to be careful, I think, in how we go about that so that we're not disrupting the system and punishing folks who maybe made an inadvertent error that fits within the arc of the language of the lawyers called knowingly.
Okay. Representative Simon, if you would like to respond to that, and then we have a couple other people with questions.
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Broad, for the spirit of the amendment. I do, however, oppose the amendment, and let me tell you just briefly why. But first, let me get to your point about line 1.20. This is also in the federal act.
And specific intent doesn't mean no intent. The intent standard is knowingly. But specific intent, at least the way that I learned it in law school, was this. If I go to a crowd of people and I search out and find John Doe, a specific person, and I shoot and kill him, that is specific intent. If I fire into the crowd and I shoot and kill John Doe, that is reckless. That is line 1.19. That's reckless disregard. I didn't intend to shoot that person, but I knowingly killed somebody. I just didn't seek out that particular person. That's what knowingly means, and that's what the standard is in all the 22 states and the federal government. Now, as to the amendment, although I absolutely understand where Representative Broad is going with this and where some of the stakeholders are, I don't think this gets there, and this is why. First of all, I think that it's internally inconsistent somewhat, because remember, this only applies to those who knowingly perpetrate these acts. And so what it essentially says is, even though the employer, by definition, having knowingly done it, knows that they've done it, we're asking an employee to notifying them about something that they already, by definition, know they did, because you can only be liable if you knowingly did it. Secondly, this is sort of, we got to be careful about right to cure and not lapsing into the sort of finder keepers territory. And it's true, as Mr. Beinwax said earlier, I used a shoplifting analogy, but I in no way mean to impugn the integrity of anyone in the room. What I mean, though, and it is a good analogy, I think, not that they are evil shoplifters, but the analogy is this. If I go into a Best Buy store and I knowingly take 5 iPods, and the security catches up with me as I'm about to get in my car, I don't get to say, you know what, you got me. Here are your 5 iPods, I'll just be on my way. I don't get to do that if I knowingly did it. However, if I'm in there with a 4-year-old, and the 4-year-old puts it in my bag, and to my horror, I'm stopped at my car, and I didn't know anything about it, then I do get to go my own separate way. And so that's the difference here, and we have to be really careful, and I don't think this does that. That's the shoplifting analogy. That's the full extent of the shoplifting analogy. I would also say, more importantly, in terms of the money, if we put this amendment on, I can say with near certainty that we wouldn't get the federal bonus. You have in your packets, I think you should, a great memo that Mark Shepard did as to this engrossment of the bill about whether we do in fact meet the requirements. And if you look, you can do it on your own time, at why Michigan was denied the federal bonus. It has to do with issues of this kind. Not exactly, but issues of this kind in terms of the intent standards. So if we monkey around with that, if it's possible, we'll lose that. And then finally, I just point out one other practical thing. Not all whistleblowers are employees. Some of them are outside auditors, they're investigators. They could even, I suppose, be competitors. So I don't think this would get at it entirely, because not all whistleblowers are employees. That's all I got.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just in response to the comment about not all whistleblowers are employees, but that's what has always been presented to us, is that folks are concerned about going forward because it's their employer, because it's the person they're being contracted with. And so, I think that argument doesn't quite work. And just for members' information, this essentially just says if you have a compliance office, the person who has found the issue just needs to inform the compliance officer, and then if they don't take action at that point, then all bets are off. And so it just gives an opportunity to fix the problem from the outset. And, you know, this thing about knowingly, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a small business owner who toils under the changing regulations of government. But I do think that if you put in a code, you're knowingly putting in a code. If your supervisor tells you to put in a code, they're knowingly telling you to put in that code, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you knew it was wrong. And so that's the gray area that I think a non-lawyer would look at and say, well, what does knowingly actually mean, and how does it actually impact what is versus what we all think is?
Okay, we're going to have a brief comment from Representative Gottwald, our question, and then one from Abler, and then we're going to have to vote on the amendment in the bill in about 30 seconds.
Mr. Chair, how did you know it was going to be so brief? Pretty clairvoyant. Now, Mr. Simon, I'm almost certain to Representative Simon, I can vote for this bill if we have something in here that goes to, you mentioned the spirit,
If we need to change it somehow technically to be more acceptable, that's one thing. But the right to cure or the opportunity to cure is very important. I think that's a critical concept. Whistleblowers aren't necessarily going to know knowingly. They're not going to adjudicate knowingly before they bring forward their concern. And to ask them to do that internally, correct a situation that may or may not have been knowingly done, I think is a good thing. I think that's a good piece to this legislation. I'd be glad to vote for the bill if you're willing to do that. But if instead we're going to let people do fishing trips and throw these things against the wall to see if they stick, I think that is a problem. And in this case, they're not going to take it internal. It's not going to be addressed there. It's going to be addressed only by going to state officials or others and then prosecution and so forth. And then we'll find out knowingly. But after much effort, cost, pain, heartache, etc. So,
Representative Abler,
that was short. Anyway, Justin Simon, I just had only a short moment to chat with you about this. From the small provider point of view, being found right in court still ruins us. 10, 20, 30 grand. The day is not a good day. And so all these terms are things you litigate. I get a letter from Medicare, it's $2,000 per violation, and I'm terrified to bill them sometimes. And so I think as you move forward, you have a bill that you call bipartisan with 35 authors from one party. You have people who are very credible with an amendment. They want to help you get this to go. I urge you to accept it as a placeholder. And let us work on this. I'm against fraud and all that. Let us help you accomplish your goal. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I thought Representative Averland was going to ask for a roll call, so I will.
Okay. We're going to vote on the broad amendment, and the roll call has been called. So...
Huntley?
No.
Gabler?
Yes.
Angel?
No.
Broad?
Yes.
Fun?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Summer?
Yes.
Cliff?
No.
Gottwald?
Yes.
Hayden?
No.
Hosh?
No.
Giffmeyer?
Yes.
Liebling?
No.
Murphy? Matrona? Kevin?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Wood?
No.
Galsey?
No.
Flower?
No.
Powell?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
The vote was 10 in favor of the amendment, 12 opposed, so the amendment is not adopted. And let's move on to the bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
What?
Nothing.
Yeah, I think it passed.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you.
Oh, and by the way, on terms of the fiscal note, I don't think the department has made the case that there's going to be this cost, and so I'm going to recommend that that the committee or the department will be required to absorb the cost. And what? Okay, and we're going to go about another 10 minutes max, because we've got to clear out for Representative Thiessen's committee. But we have two people, we have four signed up to talk about the governor's GAMC proposal, and we'll probably get to the first two today. Brad Plowman from Regents Hospital. Mr. Plowman.
Hi, everyone ready?
Yep. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. My name is Brad Plowman. I'm the Director of Financial Planning at Regents Hospital in St. Paul. I thank you for the opportunity to be in front of you and to testify on the governor's proposal to significantly reduce the General Assistance Medicaid Program, or GAMC. I want you to know it's our intent to provide you with the impact this proposal has on our hospital. However, details of this are really limited. We don't have a lot of information from the department yet on how this is going to play itself out, particularly in the uncompensated funds. So we really have more questions than answers, but I'll do our best to provide alternative recommendations. As you may know, Regions is a safety net hospital in East Metro and the second largest provider of charity care in the state. About 60% of our funds come from government programs, and we provide a disproportionate share of charity care. In 2007, Regions alone provided about $17.1 million of charity care costs. That's cash out of pocket, not based on our charges or anything else. That's our actual cash out of pocket cost that we put into charity care. That covered about 27,000 patients from 85 of the 87 counties. The governor's proposal to scale back the program will hinder our ability to continue to provide charity care at that kind of a level. GAMC covers low-income individuals who qualify for MA but are not eligible for MA benefits. They're usually not insured, they're usually very low income, and they experience behavioral health issues. The governor is proposing that current coverage for inpatient GAMC will be replaced with limited funding from an uncompensated pool, and then that's going to be augmented with a scaled-back set of outpatient benefits. For Regions, about 40% of our admissions come through behavioral health for GAMC patients. And we doubt that the decline will be offset by more dollars coming in for the outpatient benefits. Those patients will still become our inpatients. But replacing the inpatient GAMC dollars with an outpatient fund doesn't address the main issues in terms of why they're coming there. They'll still show up as inpatient admissions. They'll still be the same amount of cost. We've just changed the amount of funding formula that's available for them. We'll get those same number of patients with the same conditions, the same costs, they'll just have less coverage. Second, we're very concerned about how these changes will impact the state's ability to leverage the federal DSH dollars, which in the past has funded the quarterly supplemental hospital payments. Those payments, we believe, will be eliminated under this proposal. And we calculate, therefore, that the state is not maximizing the federal match on those supplemental payments. Furthermore, the state will be tapping into the funds meant for high Medicaid disproportionate share hospitals and putting those funds into the general fund. Those hospitals with the greatest MA and GA populations will lose the most, therefore, in this kind of transaction. Those hospitals and care systems that create the federal match, we believe, should receive the funds from the federal match. By keeping the GAMC funds in the disproportionate hospitals, both the state and the hospitals will get more federal funding. We do support an uncompensated care fund. The uncompensated care fund should be targeted to those that incur the cost for uncompensated patients, however, not uncompensated copays. Many of the uncompensated cares are residual copays and high deductibles that some hospitals are now absorbing. We will continue to struggle with those sort of costs. However, our issue is that many of the patients that will fall into the uncompensated fund will primarily hit two or three or four hospitals in the state, not the broad group of hospitals that much of the funding will go towards. All the hospitals are currently struggling with these high unpaid deductibles. But the big cost are those hospitals that take on the uncompensated patients, not just the underinsured. Over the biennium, Regions will lose approximately $38 million in GAMC dollars. And perhaps we'll recover, based on our best estimate, about $20 million from the uncompensated care pool. That leads us to an annual loss of about $9 million a year in an institution that's already provided about $17 million of out-of-pocket charity costs. The hospitals with the highest Medicaid populations have the thinnest or negative margins, and this proposal makes that problem even worse. We understand the state's in tough economic times, and healthcare is a huge cost driver, but we don't believe that eliminating inpatient GAMC is the answer, since it leaves federal money on the table and it does not cover those who most need it. We have a few ideas on how to decrease overall state costs, and it will allow us to serve the most vulnerable population. First, we think we have to maximize the federal dollars, particularly region CPEs and other CPEs at other institutions. We have to ensure the federal matches go to the institutions creating those matches. We need to target any uncompensated funds to those serving uncompensated patients. And then add back the inpatient care benefit for behavioral health, since the inpatient hospitals are one of the last resorts for those with inpatient or with behavioral health issues. And finally, we feel we should continue to invest in financial counseling, such as the State Primary Care Access Initiative. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the governor's recommendations adversely affect the disadvantaged patients and the safety net providers that serve them. We respectfully request that you consider those facts as you explore the alternatives to the governor's budget proposal. Thanks for the opportunity, and we'll try to answer some questions.
Any questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And, by the way, let me just interrupt. We're going to have to adjourn this meeting after this, and Dr. Belzer and Mike Mahoney and Buck McAlpine, we'd like to have you back, but you'll be first on whatever agenda there is that day. Tomorrow? Okay. If you can make it tomorrow, we'll hear from you. This is a very important issue and a very tough decision that we're going to have to make. So, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if we could get a copy of the testimony.
Can we get a copy of your testimony?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, seeing none, the meeting is adjourned, and again, my apologies.